Actually, that's me who's supposed to be the associate director, and the director's over there, so.
Okay. We won't tell him.
Yeah, that's right. If it's not too inappropriate, I'd like to meet. Yes? All right. If it's not too inappropriate, I'd like to begin by thanking the Philadelphia Society in general and Stan Evans in particular for the invitation to speak today. It's my first official participation in a society meeting, and I hope it will testify to Stan's wisdom and not my lack thereof. I'm here, at least in part, as a surrogate for Father Robert Sirico of the Acton Institute, whose new job as spiritual advisor to Dick Morris has unfortunately kept him away. Actually, Father Sirico had to be away, but does send his greetings. In lieu of his familiar face, I'll be offering a familiar argument, or at least an argument that's well known to some, if not many, of you. My topic is the birth of freedom. I'll be talking about the spiritual foundations of limited government, not so much its particular historical manifestations. In particular, I'll be speaking about ancient Athens, not in its participatory democracy, which many consider to be Athens' greatest legacy of freedom, of course, but in the moral and religious character of the thought of one of its citizens, Socrates. I begin by noting that two facts distinguish Western civilization from all other civilizations known to man. First, only the West has developed the institutions, habits, and love of liberty. Despite the worst efforts of the multicultural left to obfuscate the facts, true liberty exists and flourishes today only in places directly or indirectly influenced by the West. Indeed, as many friends of liberty have pointed out, it is, to a certain extent, an irony that the very people who castigate the West for oppressing the world use Western categories of freedom, democracy, and justice. Of course, there's a certain ease or a certain comfort for them to make these attacks because they can always go back to their comfortable academic positions in Western institutions. Secondly, besides its devotion to liberty, the West has been distinguished by a particular characteristic, a peculiar internal tension. Obviously, I don't mean tensions between city and countryside, rich and poor, even ethnic and religious groups. Those, in one form or another, those tensions have existed in every civilization. Indeed, they have, we could say, been an inherent part of civilization as such. Rather, the West's particular tension stems from an intellectual question, but one which is profoundly practical for both individuals and society alike. Namely, the question, what is the good life? What life should you and I lead? And, most importantly, how do we know what that is? In the West, this question has been the central issue between two sides in a great debate. In every other civilization, the good life has been defined and guided by religious authority, often with the backing of the state. The West is unique because it has had another contender, philosophy, or the pursuit of wisdom through human reason alone. Now, I don't mean to give an initial misimpression here. The misimpression would be that because the West has had liberty and philosophy, that therefore it owes its liberty to philosophy. Rather, or that philosophy has somehow prevented religious tyranny. Of course, some religions have enslaved man rather than set him free. But, as I'm sure John will show, and David, that's not biblical religion, not the religion of the West, which has a fundamental respect for the dignity of the individual as created in the image and likeness of God. It is my argument instead that the character of the philosophy peculiar to the West has brought it into dialogue with biblical religion in such a way as to give birth to our attachment to liberty in its highest form, namely the liberty of mind and soul, the liberty that is at the core of all other liberties, including the idea of limited government. To the church fathers, Athens meant the way of life pursued by those in Athens, which, as the Apostle Paul discovered while preaching on Mars Hill, was devoted to endless discussion and argumentation. These disputations of the chattering classes, as we would call them, were a decayed form of the original higher and more serious way of life pursued by Socrates. In discussing Socrates, however, we must begin by admitting that he was not altogether unique. For one thing, he was not the first or only philosopher in the ancient world. Anaxagoras, Protagoras, Thales, Heraclitus, and a number of others preceded him in the quest for knowledge. And we know from historical and archaeological data that other civilizations have had their sages, wise men, and thinkers. So what makes Socrates and his philosophic pursuit unique? Indeed, so unique as to give the West and its thought a particular moral and indeed liberal flavor. According to Cicero, Socrates was unique because he was the first person to bring philosophy down from the heavens to examine what actually happens on Earth. He was the first person to seek wisdom, not by examining stars and rocks, but by investigating the speeches and actions of human beings as he found them in political communities. Socrates was unique because he was the first philosopher to take human concerns seriously. Of course, he didn't start out this way. As we know from Aristophanes' Clouds, he began his time in his youth as a stargazer and natural scientist. He turned from the ways of Anaxagoras and others, however. He stopped scoffing at human life and how insignificant it seems from the eternal perspective of the cosmos. He went into the marketplace and talked with all kinds of people about what constitutes the way of life that is really worth living for a human being. Socrates' turn from exclusive interest in natural science does not mean that he abandoned the life of reason. On the contrary, he saw his turn to human concerns as the foundation of the truly rational life. After all, what good does it do to know the course of the stars if you don't know what the good life is? The key to Socrates' break, I would argue, is found in the fact that Anaxagoras and the others presumed that they knew what the good life was. The life devoted to scientific inquiry of the cosmos. As much as he respected them, Socrates saw a terrible problem with their view. It presumes to have answered the most important question for any human being to address, the question whether God exists and rules over the universe and our lives. The question, in other words, whether the good life is in fact the life devoted to piety. Let me explain this by a brief historical return to the philosophic activity happening in Athens just prior to Socrates. Anaxagoras was, for example, arguing that science could prove that gods and the divine did not exist. At the same time, pious Athenians believed that Zeus, for example, caused lightning. He flung lightning bolts to earth in fits of rage and anger at injustice. Anaxagoras disagreed. From his scientific observations of meteorology, he concluded that lightning is caused solely by atmospheric forces. He was, in a way, the first Willard Scott. Unlike our friend Willard, though, Anaxagoras thought that science disproves miracles and that no rational person could believe in the stories told about gods who intervene in the natural order. To give an example closer to home, Anaxagoras would have argued, as Celsus did in his disputes with the church fathers, that when bushes are on fire, they burn and are consumed. There is no burning bush. Or to take a New Testament example of the conflict between the religious view and non-Socratic philosophy, when St. Paul went to Athens and held friendly disputations with the philosophers, they listened intently, the writer tells us. But the writer of Acts also says that when Paul proclaimed Christ risen from the dead, at that point, the philosophers scoffed. To their hyper-rationalist minds, miracles were the fabrications of ignorant, irrational people who could not understand events explicable by any competent scientist. Socrates disagreed with these rationalists emphatically. He argued that they were, in fact, irrational because they began by saying that miracles and religious belief based on miracles is false. Yet, how can anyone make that claim, Socrates argued, unless he can prove that God does not exist and does not miraculously intervene in the natural order. And far from proving this point, those Greek rationalists merely assumed that there is no God who can violate immutable scientific laws. So Anaxagoras' claim that the scientific life lived apart from God is the truly rational life, collapsed in Socrates' view. In order to pursue a truly rational life, Socrates was therefore compelled to turn toward God, not away from him. He sought the truth about God in what pious people said about him. Socrates was drawn towards God and became open to religion in order to become truly free in his mind and soul. Ironically, as we all know, this turn did not earn Socrates a reputation for piety. In fact, he was accused, tried, and executed, in part at least, for not believing in the gods of Athens. How can we explain this incongruity? And it really is an incongruity. How can the same Socrates, who refused to accept dogmatic atheism, be accused of impiety? We must remember that Socrates asked searching questions not only of the scientists, but also of the believers. He pursued the truth about God even when that pursuit made some uncomfortable or even angry. Does this mean that Socrates was arrogant, that he somehow dismissed the religious accounts? No, I would say quite the contrary. He took the claim of religion to know the truth at its full face value. He wanted to know the truth with as much clarity as is possible for the human mind. He therefore pursued religious and moral truth openly. In fact, he even claimed in Plato's Apology divine sanction for his inquiries. To call Socrates and his followers atheists is therefore to completely misunderstand the life of Socratic philosophy. And to say that Western philosophy is in its origin not open and friendly to religion, especially biblical religion, and to a constant and continually renewing dialogue with biblical religion, is likewise wrong, I would argue. Socrates' longing for truth made him seek out such a dialogue, in fact. And it is this dialogue, begun in Athens and carried on down throughout the ages in Christianity, Judaism, and to some extent in Islam, certainly medieval Islam, that is the true womb or birthplace of the West's historic devotion to the highest forms of liberty. Because Socratic philosophy does not pretend to know more than it does. It is not boastful or proud. It has approached biblical, revealed religion, and in particular, biblical religion and its one mysterious God, with an open and searching countenance, and has trusted believers to respond in kind. This openness, which is the antithesis of both strident nihilism and the sort of easygoing relativism we see so much today, fosters liberalism, I would argue, in the deepest sense, in that it creates generosity on both sides of the divide between reason and revelation, and spurs all of us to constant attempts at synthesis which do not violate or do violence to the claims of either side. This generosity does not require and is indeed hostile to compulsion or coercion, especially by the state. It has been, is, and must be the voluntary coming together of nobly minded individuals. This liberalism of soul entails a love of liberty generally, which we have seen historically in some of the greatest thinkers of the West, particularly religious thinkers. Is it so surprising that those most often associated with the development of lawful government, constitutionalism, or who simply had a hostility to tyranny, have also been some of those most deeply affected by Socratic philosophy, whether in its Platonic or Aristotelian forms? We need only mention a few well-known examples. In antiquity, Cicero. In Islam, Al-Farabi. In Judaism, Moses Maimonides. In Christianity, St. Thomas Aquinas, Erasmus, and the school at Salamanca. In modern times, Lord Acton, just to name a few of the most illustrious. There is then, I would argue, an intricate connection between the peculiar dialogue begun by Socratic philosophy and the birth of freedom in the West. Love of truth has led to dialogue between reason and revelation, which in turn has given birth to generosity and liberal temper that demands freedom from coercion for the minds and souls of individuals. Ironically, this coercion can come from philosophy itself. When Western philosophy has lost its respectful Socratic flavor, it has been as dangerous to ordered liberty as almost any abuse by the centralized state. Indeed, the times in which freedom has been most threatened have also been the times when Socratic philosophy has not been the prime shaper of our intellectual world. Think of the arrogant dismissal of religion by the philosophe and the subsequent persecutions of the French Revolution. Or recall Marx and Nietzsche's rejection of Socratic rationalism in favor of philosophies designed to boldly recreate the world. These rejections were absolutely necessary for the philosophical and practical respectability of communism and fascism, the greatest enemies of freedom the world has ever seen. The same danger lurks in our time, especially in the academy, which is, I regret to say, the least free place in America today. Why? In part, I would argue, because of the removal of Socratic philosophy as an integral part of university curriculums. Who reads Plato these days? This has, I would say, removed the spur, for reason to confront the claims of biblical religion in humility and openness. Not surprisingly, the resulting intellectual hubris has grown intolerant of all serious discussion and pursuit of the truth of the claims of biblical religion. Such views today are mocked and reviled, not taken seriously, certainly by teachers of philosophy. In that situation, all lovers of truth and liberty lose, believer and non-believer alike. It is therefore incumbent on all of us who care about liberty to see that Socrates' legacy is preserved and revitalized, in particular through the study of the great books. In the end, Socrates' life has won such universal praise throughout the centuries after his death because it was, like almost no other before or since, an open and unwavering quest for the truth, and especially for religious and moral truth. As a result, Socrates never ridiculed religion and told his interlocutors never to do such an ignoble thing. Indeed, it is not too much to say that Socrates found, in examining the religious life, the answer to his noble quest. For that reason, Lord Acton, the great champion of liberty, contended, and I quote, "Socrates really died for religion, because he urged men to judge of right and wrong, not by the will or sentiment or custom, but by the light which God has set in each man's reason and conscience." Lord Acton was certainly right in this respect. Socrates lived for the emancipation of the mind and soul from its attachment to anything but truth, and for our ascent to the highest life and the most profound liberty.